A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's prompt this week is basically a marital dispute with nutritional science attached. He wants to know why vegetables get this universal halo from nutritionists when, on paper, you could get your vitamins and fiber elsewhere. From fruit, from supplements, from fortified cardboard if it came to that. His argument, and I'm paraphrasing a fairly long and detailed prompt here, is that if you asked a hungry person what they actually want, a hunter-gatherer, a guy who just spent 8 hours doing DIY, the answer is hydration, protein, fat, salt. Vegetables are the lowest effort to benefit foodstuff, the least essential, the least tasty, and the hardest to get excited about. Meanwhile, his wife Hannah is what he describes as an ardent vegetable enthusiast, who's been known to open conversations with strangers by asking how many vegetables they consume that day, and who uses vegetable consumption as a yardstick for judging trustworthiness. He suspects she might be an extreme case, but probably has a point. So the question is, why should we all be eating more vegetables?
There's a lot to pull apart here, and I want to start with the thing Daniel gets right before I push back on the thing he gets wrong. He's correct that if you're starving, or even just depleted after physical labor, your body isn't screaming for a salad. That's not a design flaw. The hunger signals we inherited are tuned for caloric density and electrolyte replenishment, because for most of human history, the problem was scarcity. A body that craved broccoli over brisket got outcompeted. So the craving hierarchy he's describing is real. It's just answering a different question than the one nutritionists are answering.
The question nutritionists are answering being, what keeps you alive at 65? Not what gets you through the next 2 hours.
Wait, no. I said I was going to push back and then I opened with, exactly. Let me try that again. The craving hierarchy is real, but it's a short-term optimization engine running on hardware that never anticipated abundance. Nutritionists are playing the long game. And the long game has some surprises.
Walk me through the surprises. Daniel's framing is essentially, vegetables are a delivery vehicle for things you can get elsewhere. If that's true, they're optional. What's wrong with that?
The thing that's wrong with it's that it treats vitamins and fiber as the whole story, and it's not even half the story. Let me give you the headline finding that reframes this entire conversation. There was a massive meta-analysis published a few years back. Wang and colleagues, 2021, looking at something like 2 million person years of follow-up across 26 cohorts. They found that 5 servings of fruits and vegetables per day was associated with the lowest mortality risk. But here's the part that matters for Daniel's question. Above 5 servings, additional fruit didn't move the needle much. Additional vegetables did. Fruit topped out. Vegetables kept going.
So fruit hits a ceiling, and vegetables don't.
That's what the data suggests, and that immediately tells you there's something in vegetables that isn't just vitamins and fiber, because fruit has plenty of both. If the story were just micronutrient delivery, the curves would look the same. They don't.
What's the something?
I'm going to give you a few somethings, and the first one is the one most people miss entirely, the gut microbiome. Vegetables contain unique fiber structures, things like inulin, resistant starch, various oligosaccharides that aren't just bulk roughage for moving things along. They're selective food sources for specific bacterial strains. Fruit fiber is different. It tends to be more pectin-heavy, more soluble, fermented faster and higher up in the digestive tract. Vegetable fiber tends to be more complex, more resistant, and it reaches the distal colon where a whole different set of bacteria live.
So you're feeding different neighborhoods.
You're feeding different neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods that get fed by vegetable fiber are the ones most strongly associated with reduced inflammation, better immune regulation, lower colorectal cancer risk, the short-chain fatty acids those bacteria produce, butyrate, propionate. Those are signaling molecules that affect everything from gut barrier integrity to appetite regulation to brain function. You can't supplement your way to that. You can eat fruit, and you'll feed some bacteria, but not the same ones, not in the same place.
This is the point where Daniel would say, fine, but I can take a fiber supplement.
And this is where I'd say, a fiber supplement is like giving a city one type of food and hoping the whole economy thrives. Most fiber supplements are a single compound, psyllium husk, methylcellulose, inulin by itself. Real vegetables are a complex matrix of dozens of fiber types plus polyphenols plus other compounds that interact with each other and with the gut environment in ways we're still mapping. The diversity matters. There's work showing that people who eat 30 or more different plant types per week have measurably more diverse gut microbiomes than people who eat 10 or fewer, even if total fiber grams are similar.
30 different plant types a week.
30. That's not 30 servings. That's 30 distinct species. Different vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, nuts, herbs. The diversity of the input shapes the diversity of the output.
I eat maybe 6 things.
Most people do. The average Western diet rotates through about 15 to 20 plant species total. Hunter-gatherers, actual documented ones, not the hypothetical hungry man in Daniel's prompt. The Hadza in Tanzania, for instance. They regularly consume over 100 different plant species across a year. Their gut microbiomes are radically more diverse than ours, and they have essentially none of the chronic inflammatory diseases we spend our lives managing.
The Hadza also don't have desk jobs and air pollution, so I'm cautious about single variable comparisons. But the microbiome diversity point lands. What else?
Polyphenols. These are plant compounds that aren't vitamins, aren't minerals, aren't fiber. They're a completely separate category of bioactive molecules. Flavonoids, phenolic acids, still beans, lignans. They do an enormous range of things. They're antioxidants, they modulate inflammation, some of them cross the blood-brain barrier, some of them affect gene expression through epigenetic mechanisms. And vegetables, particularly dark leafy greens, cruciferous vegetables, alliums like onions and garlic, are absolutely loaded with specific polyphenols that fruit doesn't have in the same concentrations or the same varieties.
Give me an example.
Sulforaphane. It's a compound produced when you chew raw or lightly cooked cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts. It activates a pathway called NRF2, which is basically the body's master switch for antioxidant defense. It doesn't just act as an antioxidant itself, it tells your cells to upregulate their own internal antioxidant production. Fruit doesn't do that. No fruit does that. You have to eat cruciferous vegetables.
So it's not delivering a thing. It's triggering a system.
It's triggering a system. And sulforaphane is just one of hundreds of these compounds. Quercetin in onions, allicin in garlic, lutein in celery and peppers. Each one has its own set of targets and effects, and they interact with each other in ways we can't capture in a supplement pill. You can buy sulforaphane capsules. They don't work as well as eating broccoli. The matrix matters.
Daniel's going to say vegetables are still the least tasty category.
I think what Daniel means by tasty is hits the fat, salt, umami reward pathways that evolve to signal rare and valuable calories. Vegetables don't hit those pathways hard because they were never scarce. You didn't need a neurological reward system to motivate you to eat leaves. Leaves were everywhere. The reward system is calibrated for the stuff that was hard to get. That doesn't mean vegetables are objectively less delicious. It means your brain's definition of delicious was shaped by an environment where butter and salt and roasted meat were the limiting factors.
That's a very charitable reframe of vegetables taste bad.
I'm not saying they taste like pizza. I'm saying the tastiness complaint is mostly about dopamine signaling, not about the actual sensory experience. And here's the thing, you can retrain that. People who shift to diets higher in vegetables consistently report that their taste preferences change over weeks to months. The reward system recalibrates. A roasted carrot with olive oil and salt starts tasting sweet and satisfying in a way it didn't before. The brain adapts.
I remain skeptical that anyone has ever craved a raw celery stick the way they crave a cheeseburger. But I take your point about adaptation. Let me ask you something else. Daniel's prompt has this subtext, and it's not just Daniel. I hear this from a lot of people, that vegetables are somehow morally loaded. Hannah judges trustworthiness by vegetable consumption. That's not a nutritional claim. That's a social one. Is there anything to that?
There is, actually, and it's been studied. There's work in moral psychology showing that people do use food choices as proxies for character judgment. Eating vegetables, and more broadly, eating clean or healthy, gets mapped onto traits like self-discipline, trustworthiness, even moral virtue. It's called moralization of food. Once a food choice becomes moralized, people start judging others by it, sometimes quite harshly.
So Henna's vegetable trustworthiness test has academic backing.
It does, though I'd add that the moralization of food is also associated with some pretty unhealthy patterns. Orthorexia, disordered eating, social anxiety around meals. The line between I care about nutrition and I'm judging your soul by your side dish is worth watching, but Daniel seems aware that Hannah might be an extreme case. He said as much.
He did. He also said she probably has a point, so let's land the point. If someone, Daniel, a listener, whoever, is currently eating minimal vegetables and wants to know what they're actually missing, that they can't replicate with fruit and supplements, what's the one-sentence version?
You're missing the complex, multi-target biochemical signaling system that evolved alongside human biology over millions of years, and that we haven't come close to replicating in isolated compounds. And the evidence suggests that missing it accelerates basically every chronic disease we care about.
That's a long sentence.
It's a complicated system. Short version, vegetables do things nothing else does, and the data shows it.
Let me poke at the data for a second. The Wong analysis you mentioned, 5 servings, vegetables keep giving, fruit tops out. How confident are we that this isn't just confounding? People who eat more vegetables also tend to exercise more, smoke less, have higher incomes, better healthcare access. The standard healthy user problem.
It's the standard critique of nutritional epidemiology, and it's fair. The Wong paper controlled for a long list of confounders. Age, BMI, smoking, physical activity, alcohol, education, income, marital status, baseline health conditions. The associations held. But you're right that residual confounding is always possible in observational work. The stronger evidence, in my view, comes from the mechanistic studies and the randomized controlled trials on intermediate endpoints. When you randomize people to higher vegetable intake, you see improvements in blood pressure, in inflammatory markers, in glycemic control, in gut barrier function. Those aren't confounded by lifestyle, they're causal.
And the effect sizes?
Modest but real. We're not talking about vegetables curing cancer. We're talking about shifting the probability distribution of chronic disease by maybe 10 to 20% over decades. That sounds small until you realize that a 10 to 20% reduction in cardiovascular mortality across a population is enormous. It's the difference between a public health win and a public health crisis.
Daniel's other point, and I want to make sure we address it directly, is about effort to benefit ratio. Vegetables require washing, chopping, sometimes cooking. They go bad in the fridge. They're not grab and go the way fruit is. If you're exhausted after a long day, the friction matters.
The friction matters enormously, and I think this is where a lot of nutrition advice fails. Telling people to eat more vegetables without addressing the practical barriers is just moralizing with extra steps. Frozen vegetables solve a lot of this. They're pre-washed, pre-chopped, they don't rot, they're often flash frozen at peak ripeness, so nutrient content is comparable to, or sometimes better than, fresh. You can dump a handful of frozen spinach into basically anything. Pasta sauce, soup, scrambled eggs, and it wilts in 30 seconds. The effort to benefit ratio changes completely when you remove the prep work.
Frozen vegetables. That's your big pitch.
Frozen vegetables and a little bit of fat. Fat carries flavor, and it increases the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins and a bunch of those polyphenols I mentioned. Roast frozen broccoli with olive oil and salt at high heat for 20 minutes. It's not a cheeseburger, but it's also not punishment.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier about hunter-gatherers and plant diversity. Daniel brought up the hungry hunter-gatherer as evidence that vegetables are an afterthought. But you're saying actual hunter-gatherers eat more plant diversely than we do.
Way more. The popular image of hunter-gatherers as primarily meat-eaters is decades out of date. The Hadza get something like 30 to 40% of their calories from plants, depending on the season, and they eat an enormous variety of tubers, berries, leaves, seeds. The idea that pre-agricultural humans just ate steak and ignored plants is fantasy. Plants were always part of the picture. The difference is they weren't eating the same 5 vegetables year-round. They were eating whatever was in season across dozens or hundreds of species.
Which brings us back to the microbiome diversity argument.
It does. And it also reframes Daniel's effort to benefit Point in an interesting way. For a hunter-gatherer, gathering plants is high effort. You're walking miles, digging tubers, processing fibrous roots. The caloric return is modest. But the long-term health return, the thing they weren't consciously optimizing for, but that shaped the food environment our biology expects, that return is substantial. We've eliminated the caloric scarcity problem and kept the biology that expects plant diversity. The mismatch is the issue.
So the hungry DIY guy, craving salt and protein, isn't wrong about what his body wants. He's just got a body that was designed for a world where the next meal might be 3 days away, and the plant matter came along for free with the foraging.
His cravings are honest. They're just answering yesterday's problem.
Let's talk about the taste thing one more time, because I think it's the real barrier for a lot of people. You mentioned retraining the reward system. How long does that actually take?
The studies on taste preference adaptation suggest somewhere between 2 and 8 weeks of consistent exposure for the palate to recalibrate. The key variable seems to be repeated exposure without overwhelming the vegetable with hyper-palatable additions. If you drown broccoli in cheese sauce every time, your brain never learns to associate broccoli itself with reward. If you roast it with oil and salt, still palatable, still enjoyable, but not drowning out the vegetable, the adaptation happens faster.
There's also the texture issue. A lot of people who say they hate vegetables actually hate the way they were prepared as children. Boiled into submission, no salt, no fat, gray and limp.
The boiled-to-death vegetable is a crime against nutrition and against pleasure. Overboiling leaches water-soluble vitamins into the cooking water, destroys texture, and concentrates bitterness. Roasting, grilling, sautéing. High heat methods that create browning, those transform vegetables completely. Maillard reactions on Brussels sprouts or cauliflower produce nutty, savory flavors that have nothing in common with the steamed mush of childhood trauma.
Childhood trauma is a strong phrase for bad broccoli.
I've seen things in my pediatric practice. The damage is real.
I believe you. All right, let me try to synthesize where we are. Daniel's prompt asks why vegetables are treated as essential when you can get vitamins and fiber elsewhere. The answer seems to have several layers. Layer 1. Vegetables contain unique fiber structures that feed gut bacteria in ways fruit fiber doesn't, with downstream effects on inflammation and disease risk. Layer 2. Vegetables contain polyphenols and other bioactives that trigger internal defense systems, sulforaphane in the NRF2 pathway being the poster child, and these don't have equivalents in fruit or supplements. Layer 3. The diversity of plant intake matters independently of total quantity, and vegetables are the easiest way to push that diversity number up. Layer 4. The epidemiological data shows vegetables specifically have benefits that don't plateau the way fruit benefits do. Did I miss anything?
The only thing I'd add is the displacement effect. Every serving of vegetables on your plate is a serving of something else that isn't there. In a food environment where hyperpalatable, calorie-dense, nutrient-poor foods are cheap and everywhere, vegetables function partly as a defensive measure. They fill stomach volume, they slow gastric emptying, they reduce the glycemic response to the rest of the meal. Even if vegetables had zero unique bioactive compounds, which they don't, they'd still be useful simply as a replacement for worse options.
The defensive eating argument.
It's not the most inspiring framing, but it's real. Vegetables as harm reduction.
I think Daniel would appreciate that framing more than the "your greens because they're virtuous" approach. He seems like someone who responds to mechanism and evidence, not moral imperative.
And I think that's the right response. The moralization of vegetables, the Hannah approach, if we're naming it, it works for some people. Social norms and identity signaling are powerful motivators. But for people who find that framing off-putting, the mechanistic case is actually stronger. You don't need to believe vegetables make you a good person, you just need to believe they do things to your biology that nothing else replicates.
And the frozen vegetable shortcut lowers the effort barrier.
Frozen vegetables, a sheet pan, olive oil, salt, 425 degrees Fahrenheit. 20 minutes. That's the whole system. It's not zero effort, but it's close.
I'm now imagining Daniel reading this and realizing he has to tell Hannah we sided with her on the substance, but with him on the moralizing.
That sounds about right. She's right that vegetables matter. He's right that being judged for not eating them is annoying and counterproductive. Both things can be true.
The world is complicated, and so is dinner.
That should be the show's tagline.
If a person wanted to, say, grow a very specific set of vegetables in a very small space with no natural light, what's the minimum viable setup for that?
I'm sorry. Grow vegetables with no natural light?
I got quickly.
You'd need grow lights. LED panels, full spectrum, probably in the 5,000 Kelvin range for vegetative growth. A shelving unit, some kind of hydroponic or container system. A timer for the light cycle. Most vegetables want 14 to 16 hours. A small fan for air circulation or you get mold. It's not complicated.
And the power draw?
For a small setup, maybe 200 to 300 watts total. Comparable to leaving a couple of old light bulbs on. It adds up over a month, but it's not outrageous.
And if a person were interested specifically in plants that produce the compounds you were talking about? The sulforaphane one? The ones that trigger the internal systems?
Cruciferous vegetables. Broccoli sprouts are actually the most concentrated source of sulforaphane precursor, way more than mature broccoli. You can grow those in a tray on a countertop in about 5 days. Microgreens in general are probably the highest yield option for a small indoor setup. Radish, broccoli, kale, mustard greens, all cruciferous, all fast, all dense in the compounds we were discussing.
Why?
5 to 7, depending on temperature. Soak the seeds overnight, spread them in a tray, rinse twice a day. No soil even, necessarily. Just water and a growing mat.
Hilbert, is there a reason you're asking about windowless vegetable cultivation?
Just curious about the minimum viable setup.
Just curious.
I've got a storage room that doesn't get much use.
How big a storage room?
Big enough for a shelving unit. Maybe two.
You could grow a meaningful amount of food in 2 shelving units. Leafy greens, herbs, sprouts, microgreens. You wouldn't feed a family, but you could supplement substantially. The limitation is usually the fruiting plants. Tomatoes, peppers, anything that needs to flower and set fruit wants more light intensity than leafy greens. But for the stuff we were just talking about, the high polyphenol, high fiber, gut microbiome feeding vegetables, leafy greens and cruciferous vegetables are exactly what you want, and they're the easiest things to grow indoors.
And the smell?
Shouldn't be noticeable with a basic setup. Maybe a slight earthy smell. If you're doing hydroponics and the water gets stagnant, that's a different story, but a simple drain-to-waste or cocoa coir setup shouldn't produce much odor.
You're really not going to tell us what this is for.
It's for vegetables.
Of course it is.
The sprouts thing is interesting. 5 days and you get the compound that triggers the internal defense system. That seems like a useful thing to know how to do.
It's remarkably simple. Broccoli sprout seeds are cheap, the process is nearly foolproof, and the sulforaphane yield is something like 20 to 50 times what you get from mature broccoli by weight. There's a whole community of people who grow them specifically for the health benefits.
20 to 50 times.
Per gram, yes.
So a small tray would be equivalent to a lot of mature broccoli.
A small tray of broccoli sprouts probably gives you the sulforaphane equivalent of eating several pounds of cooked broccoli. It's not a perfect substitution. You're missing the fiber and the other compounds. But for that specific pathway, sprouts are absurdly efficient.
I'll keep that in mind.
The misconception that I keep running into, and that Daniel's prompt gets at from one angle, is the idea that vegetables are just vitamin delivery vehicles. That if you cover your micronutrient bases through other means, vegetables become optional. The reality is that vegetables are doing things that have nothing to do with vitamins. They're signaling molecules. They're gut microbiome feedstocks. They're epigenetic triggers. The vitamin content is almost a side benefit. You can supplement your way out of the vegetable requirement, because we don't even fully understand everything in there, let alone how to replicate it.
And the part that's surprising is that fruit doesn't fill the same niche. Fruit is great. Eat fruit. But the data shows it tops out in a way vegetables don't, and the mechanistic story backs that up. Different fibers, different polyphenols, different bacterial targets. They're complementary, not interchangeable.
So Hannah's right about the vegetables, wrong about the moral judgment. And Daniel's right that the effort barrier is real, but wrong that there's no unique benefit. Everyone gets to be a little bit correct.
The ideal outcome for a marital nutrition dispute.
We'll be back soon, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, who's apparently going to be growing broccoli sprouts in a storage room for reasons he's chosen not to disclose.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
See you tomorrow.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.